Hello, and welcome to the No Good Poetry Podcast. Each week we talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly of poetry. This is episode 3
with
Joseph Bienvenue and
Joseph Makos. This is the good, bad, and the ugly, isn't it? Some ugly shit out there, kids. Let's make the world safer for poetry. This week on the podcast, we have a guest in town from Long Island, New York, our resident experienced designer and poet and good friend from study abroad back in the day, Jess Fiorini.
Hi, it's nice to be here. Thanks for having me. I'm from Long Island, from Amityville, from way down the block of the Amityville Horror House and across the bay from Fire Island. And currently just sort of traipsing about seeing if there's other places to live in this country that will welcome me and have me.
How's New Orleans been for you so far?
Pretty good. You guys have this thing called a buck moth caterpillar that apparently drops from the trees and can attack you at any moment.
Yeah,
I didn't know about this thing. So beyond like the great times with friends, I've been on the lookout for dropping poisonous caterpillars constantly.
Yeah, it's an issue on campus at Tulane. The students have to become aware of it. It's really like a thing because they're everywhere.
They're monsters. Have you seen them? Oh, you have. You're from here. They're monsters. If you see, look them up. They're weird little beings.
Okay, everyone. Homework assignment. So we're here today to talk a little bit about poetry, Jess's new chapbook that came out, and a little bit about her experience as an experienced designer and video games and how those things are sort of related.
How many times can you say experience in one sentence?
I'm going to try to look up all the different forms of the word experience now and try to work them into this podcast.
Well, it's definitely a funny thing defining yourself as an experienced designer, but really there are not many labels for exactly what I do. And so...
Because look... I mean, I'll get a case of wine and a bag of weed and we can have an experience. It's a design for an experience, but that's a different type of experience.
Yeah.
Tell us exactly what it means to be an experienced designer. Maybe tell us about a project or several projects you're either working on or you've done or something you're proud of. And, you know, tell our listeners what that really means.
All right. So I've been making games for about 15 years now, video games. And at some point, I started working for large-scale interaction designers. So we're talking about people who design museums, design 30-person gaming theaters. They design large spaces in which people walk in that are physical architecture but also have digital inlays in it. And my job as an experience designer is to make sure that before they get into the room, once they get in there and once they leave, that their experience and what their agency is expressed in a fluid and engaging and creative and fun way. So, for example, recently I helped design 8 games for the 30-person gaming theater where 30 people come in and shoulder to shoulder play a bunch of games on a large scale screen in front of them. But there's also all these theatrical cues that as they're going, lights are flaring or smoke is going off and it's everyone in a room. Or I've done work for something like the Museum of Natural History, where I've designed a game design course by using game design for kids that are going to come in and use the museum itself as a game design board or as a launching point for them to design experiences for other people coming to the museum. So my job is basically to encourage heuristic learning in a system of interactions that fuels agency within the people that are engaging with them.
Let's go back to that gaming theater real quick. I want to know a little bit more about that. You know, like my shoe's on fire. Oh shit. But like how I'm trying to really envision this because I've actually never been in a place like that. So is it like everyone has a joystick or is it like there's a thing on the face? We're not in the VR world yet there, but is it everyone has a controller? Everyone has a thing?
Yeah, we've used modified iPod touches as controllers. Then we have information going through on where the position of the player in the room, so we can have lighting cues on the winner or celebrate somebody or have a big celebration moment for individual players. and we can say, you guys are on the red team, you guys are on the blue team, and we can have lighting cues to show that. So it's, you know, an experience designer isn't just the one-to-one, the person to the screen. It's the person to the space, it's the person to the other people in the room, and it's also the person to the conversation they're having themselves. So I thrive on making sure that, like I said, 30 people standing shoulder to shoulder are having a great individual time, but also having a great group time.
Can you give us an example of one of the themes of one of the games? I'm really curious.
Are these like collaborative games?
Some of them are collaborative. Some of them are, you know, very clear-cut sports games. Because if you think about local multiplayer, you think soccer or you think football. We definitely have like a demolition derby-style smash-em-up fruit game where you're a piece of fruit and somebody else is a piece of fruit. And you try to smash their fruit to grab their like dull sticker and stick them on your own wall. So we've got things like that. And we've got, you know, a crazy game where you're flying through space and through the collective gravity of the players around you, you can pull space minerals into your sphere and deliver them to your planet. So things like that. And there's one where it's like cops versus robbers, but it's asynchronous. There are way more robbers than there are cops, and they're trying to break out of jail, and the cops are trying to get them, but the cops are more powerful than the robbers, which is an interesting thing that I normally have to deal with, which is balance. When you've got this many people entering a space and experiencing it, it doesn't always have to be equal, but it does have to be balanced. So everybody has to feel like their moves are important, and they're getting the feedback that says, you're doing the correct thing. And this is where you are in this weird space. And this is how you move through this weird space.
Is this, I'm trying to put myself in the space, and you've done a really good job describing it. So is it like we're walking into a four-walled screen black box theater?
It's got one giant screen that sort of wraps around the front because we find spinning around makes you want to vomit. Which I've done multiplayer VR games, which generally I'm the person who they're like, if Jess doesn't vomit, it's pretty okay. But it's a large, I mean, it's a huge screen and professional lighting above, and everyone stands up and there are spots on the floor with your number on it. You go there and you stand there with your device and you go in and like play like crazy.
Wow.
But I have recently been experimenting with multiplayer virtual reality experiences, which are interesting because you can be both in VR and sharing the same physical space, or you can be remote and still sharing the same VR space. And I think that that's a really interesting model to move forward with. And I do think is the future of communications, where you think about any like weird Star Trek, which, you know, I'm a big fan of, hologram, where you come in, or even like when they're like, we're going to have a meeting with another ship and your captain appears in front of you. Like, we're not that far away from that, except I want to make games out of it instead of just regular communication. And then there's always a thing where the internet can mess with you. So you can make an arena of virtual reality players and then have the internet change all of the programs and things around you to affect you real time.
By using like live data?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm. Like what sort of data would they?
Well, I was working with a friend and we were thinking about, you know, basically if the people in the VR space were folks that believed in gods and they would bring these gifts to the gods as they went along and collected them, but the internet players would actually be the gods and they would decide if they were happy or mad or they liked the gift or didn't, and then they would affect the environment around them you know, just through regular internet interactions to live affect what people are doing. So if they wanted to throw lightning bolts or they wanted rain to start or if they wanted an earthquake, that it was up to the masses to actually decide what the few in the arena were doing.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Okay, but can we get to that point yet? Where I'm just, can we have an interactive game? The hardest one would be like diagramming sentences.
Nobody would know. Diagramming sentences is impossible, and I don't think anyone does it anymore. Like
I just had my Latin students doing it with Latin sentences, which is actually really helpful because with complicated like Latin poetry, you can figure out how it's working a lot better if you diagram it. But they were like, yeah, I kind of remember doing that in middle school, but.
I was curious if they still taught it, because it definitely blew my mind. And I'm a poet. And I was like, nah, I don't think we should follow these rules.
They got rid of that. They got rid of cursive. They're getting, you know.
There's no cursive.
There's a lot of schools that don't teach.
Well, a lot of them are bringing them back now.
Really?
But it had disappeared for a while.
Yeah.
But how are you going to write quickly and sloppily without
They just don't. They take forever to write their notes. It's crazy. They're like meticulously writing in print.
How old are your students?
High school. I mean, I pretty much all of high school.
So that's where they're writing notes.
A lot of them never, they can't. They can't even read it. That's the weird thing. If you write in the board in cursive, they're like, I don't know what that says. Because they've never even, I mean, I guess that makes sense. Like, if you didn't learn to write it, how would you know how to read it?
Yeah.
But it's like, they're like, well, please print. All right, so this is a poetry podcast.
Yeah, we're getting this. So you know, this outrageous claim about how experienced, how the poetry, how going through the academy prepared you for doing experience design.
Well, first off, poetry got me my first job in game design. For I performed at an event. A person was in the audience who I met later, and I described how much I liked God of War. And he said, well, you're a good writer and you like video games. Let me give you a job. So the thing about video games is there's lots of jobs for writers. The second thing is, like I was saying before, poetry is a system of rules and engagements that you're presenting to the audience member to go through and give them as much agency as possible. There's no difference in planning out that experience to me. They're both the same mindset. There's nothing different between me using white space to make someone breathe differently or have a thought than there is to me making sure that the scoring mechanic gives the person the best feedback they possibly can to know how to do it more. So there's not, in my mind, all experience is equal, is flat in a way, and it's about a system of interactions that you've laid down a rule set for. And I can't think of any poetry that doesn't have some constraint, whether it being a free-form flowing of a hand, it's still a constraint in a way, and it's still expecting a certain audience member to come to it with a certain understanding or not, but it does want to say, I give you this much agency, or I give you none, and I want it totally locked down. And I think that's fine for a game as well. So it just depends on what system at play you have. And I do believe that learning forms, as learning game forms, is equivalent to learning poetry forms, because then you get to see how impact and meter matter to a reader, and how impact can be expanded or truncated depending on how long or short an experience is, or how long or short a word is, how much information you want that person to leave with, as opposed to how much you want them to come to on their own. So in my mind, there's no difference, and I don't use any different brain power or training to do so.
Jess is certainly making the world safer for poetry, that's for sure. I think that that's, you know, yeah, I think for it, what you were saying, it actually brings up a kind of how Bernadette Mayer would kind of play a game. It's a game, you know, like a lot of her exercises were gaming and games and word games and constraint games, and
sure,
how that was, that's like, I love that side of the, of sort of like teaching how to create out of the rawness and not worrying about the poem itself. Because I think that that's what a lot of poets do these days, is they're so concerned about the poem and less about their writing of the poem and how they're coming across or how they're presenting a thing, and less about the audience's experience of the poem.
Sure.
That's really what it's...
Well, we're all audience members. Even an author, once you've written your poem, you're now an audience to your own poem. You're not that author anymore. It exists without you. It's going to have legs without you. People are going to put their own meaning in it. It's not yours. It never was.
But there's so much holding on to that, the ego of the...
Yeah, but I mean, I think that... I don't think that all writers think about... They think of how an audience is react, maybe, but they don't think of it as a series of rules that are going to make people react in a certain way. But I think that's true, right? I mean, language kind of necessarily works in that way.
If you can make a diagram of a sentence, then language is a structure of rules that no matter who you are, you have to engage with. I'm not talking about... I mean, my job is very specific in gaming, is to think of the audience, but it's also the expression of idea on my side. So you may not be thinking of your audience, but you are trying to elicit an emotional response. You are trying to, even if it's your own, you are trying to do this thing. You're trying to impact a response or a stimuli in a way that would not exist if you had not put it down. So,
yeah.
And if you're a writer who's just going to pack it all up and put it in a box and burn it when you're done, then sure, I believe that there's no audience. But if you're the type of writer who's going to try to get it published and put it out, then you do care in a certain... It is a different thing. And I think that the game of writing poems and burning it in a box is as equivalent and meaningful as putting them out there. But there's no way of ignoring the fact that we have a system of language that we're dealing with, and we've got a certain amount of chits that we can move along the board.
How does that comparison also maybe fit in with allowing both in designing a game or in poetry, with allowing randomness to enter or allowing...
We're gods. We're gods when we create a game. We're gods when we create a poem. We're it. That's it. We're the voice of that world. That world can be small. It can be a 3-month project where I'm making a small game. It can be large when I'm writing a 60-page epic poem about, you know, a woman who devours the world. It doesn't matter, because in that world, you're a god, and randomness or not, you've allowed that to exist in your world.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But I guess I mean more about allowing that to be part of the process, because I would imagine it's the same in both. You certainly are trying to control as many things as you can, but aren't there some elements that you have to kind of allow to be wild cards no matter what?
Sure, and that's why I refer to it as a system rather than a solution. Because a system says, this is the skeleton that I presented to you, and now you hang some meat on it. Like, it doesn't necessarily mean that that I have solved all these problems for you. Poetry does not solve life for anyone. You know, it says, this is a thing that I want you to hang your thoughts on. So, and that's another reason why I think it's sort of audience-based, is that you're expecting a dialogue to happen. And most of my games, when there are 30 people, or experiences when there are 30 people, I'm trying to get a conversation started, and I want them to go and say, we had this experience together. What does that mean? And what can we go from here? You know, when I'm doing projects for museums, it isn't about the winner. It's about
making them part of the creation,
The dialogue circular. So making sure that they leave something behind, making sure there's an artifact within them that they go through the world. Poetry is amazing because it gets inside you. Like, it literally, you read it and it goes in your brain and it's inside you in a way that some other things don't happen that way. So if you can get in there and sort of nestle a little spot, then you can really enact real change.
It's not like I can necessarily say that we're all poets here. This is the No Good Poetry Podcast, but yeah, it makes me want to be an experience designer. I think that I missed my calling to be to do film or theater, to do something different. And I, you know, went into the poetry thing, but because I felt that, like, the theater or film, it actually encompasses all mediums, has the potential to encompass all forms. But poetry, to me, I think sometimes, I mean, we're trying to take it in all different directions, like the interactivity of cocktail poems, for example. Like, it's a game. We made a game out of a poem, you know? But, you know, it's like, I want more interactivity with poetry. I want to tear down the idea of the audience and the reader and the audience. I think sometimes it's better to make everyone on the same playing field. But I think sometimes when you go to certain readings or certain types of readings, there's a very like, okay, you're up there now in front of the mic and you're the god that's reigning in the room right now, and like, we all bow to you while you read. And then it's like a clap, clap, or like after every poem, clap, clap, or a click, click, or whatever you do. And then, or whatever the... Who's doing snapping?
It happens. Come on!
Snapping. I've always thought that more interactivity... I saw Steve Benson do a reading once where he was wearing headphones and he had a cassette player playing some script that he was reading, and he had a script. And then when you walked into the room, this was like at Hall Walls in Buffalo. And when everyone walked in the room before the reading, everyone got a little piece of paper and you weren't supposed to read it. And then you would read it, and says, at 3 minutes into the piece, say this word out loud. So the audience was doing all these things too.
But it's tricky, right? Like, because, I mean, I've seen some of those things that were great, and then, but it can easily become a gimmick that actually discourages audience participation on some level, right? Like, it can be something where it feels very forced.
And that's why you hire an experienced designer who's thought about that, what that's like to interact with those guys.
Okay.
I've said this to Joseph before, but games are the only thing that people do that said, I did this. I beat it. I won. Our team did a thing. They're not actually doing, nothing has changed in the world, but it's the only form that actually gets inside you and says, oh, I made a thing happen in this world. And I don't think that's very different, or it is non-compatible with poetry. I don't see that there's any barriers there.
If you could redesign the poetry reading as a game, how would you do it?
Well, no one would ever go. No, I think that it would start way before they got to the reading. I think you'd have preparation beforehand. I think there'd be a sense of role playing where you got to be someone else. I think that it would also last beyond the poetry reading, where you came out and perhaps participated in a world where you were building more lines or building this weird zoo of language, or, you know, I don't distinguish games from experience from toys. Like, right? It's all these crazy interactive digital artifacts that we get to play with and feel comfortable. But I think it's, again, offering a way in and also expecting different people to react and want to participate in different means. I never try to make an experience that you have to be a gamer or a person who's at the forefront to do it. If you want to be a non-participant in the background, it's still a spectacle. It's still something you want to see. And I think that that's something that poetry glosses over, in that if you're not already interested or involved in it, there's not that much for you to see or do. There's no spectacle that makes you say, I mean, unless it's like, you're reading, or Giant Tiger was reading, and you're like, well, this is obviously someone at the top of a game. Like, this is something that's going to impact anyone. But there is a, poetry is a box a lot of the times, and people outside that box don't know how to look into it. So I think a lot of it is invitation. Like, how do you get involved in this thing? How do you take a little bit of yourself? And I think you're right that it supersedes their writer's ego in a lot of way, and not a lot of writers are willing to do that. As a person who works on teams trying to make the thing that I want to make, I have to constantly subvert my ego to say, this person is an expert in what they do, therefore I'm going to believe in what they say to me, and I'm going to, you know, incorporate it. But the poet author has not yet figured out how to incorporate, not everyone, how to incorporate that and not feel challenged by it. So yeah, I think that that would
pretty
make it happen.
Few examples of that, huh? I mean, it does. I mean, you know, I think we could think of some, but if you think about the massive monolith that is poetry, how little collaborative poetry in any sort of way has happened.
Yeah, and how even the collaborative sense is usually in lockdown, where somebody's chosen another person to work in. I can't think of any examples right now, and I probably, if we researched it, we could, and probably people wrote into your podcast and told you, you guys could do another whole show on it, but poets who actively seek audience dialogue and conversation, and dialogue and conversation doesn't have to be words, it can be all sorts of things, I'm not talking about that, but a response and recall and getting back to gospel music or something where come sing this with me. It's complicated. And even that can be off-putting. So even then, but even gospel singing has a spectacle where if you're not participating, it's still a beautiful thing and it moves you. So how do we get back to making sure that poetry is engaging everybody? If that's your want, it may not be your want. You may just want to like Robert Frost that jam and just be a monolith. You may want that. I don't think it's going to serve you in the future, but it's still valid and it's still okay. It's not what I'm interested in designing, but it's okay.
So you came here, you've been in the city for a month, and you have this beautiful new chapbook.
Yes.
Actually read last week at Blood Jet at BJ's.
Mm-hmm.
And you put this book out called Make It Rain.
Mm-hmm.
Do you would you like to maybe grace us with a few pieces? You know, you can read as much as you want.
Yeah, sure.
Like, you can.
I'd also like to say that this was published at NOLA DNA And if you want a beautiful book published, you should talk to them. Independent for Amy Mateer. Awkward pose as award year, raising the bar to medium, mediocre podium middle career. Catnap in an abandoned fridge, anger as subtle as a broken child screaming out a sniper's space. I won't give that rage a name. Slippery platform dump to pass due. Would you feed the meter on that, babe? Social feed featuring first day of school, passive comments aggressively angled. Okay, fine, it was cute. Turn it down a notch, would you, dear? Your photo stream is a highly edited work. The official policy on nipples is flush this quarter. Two whole new channels dedicated to body politics. Just being that nipples are more than a body and are just asking for it. Do you know what they do with those things? Chat that red flag commentator. Keep the parasites afloat, running hit counts and bast worship. New cycle just about keeps up. Rheumatic and crippled to join Flint, a kingdom of exploitation and manipulation. Damn. He called your hand. That must burn worse yet. Are you ashamed to say goodbye? What's your white promise gasping in retreat? It's lights out, Chappie, for your understanding of culture is flat jack up on this affront. He's not a billboard. He's your brother. Married off to that nice Cynthia girl before she found out his viewing distance. Cross country there he stands, a beacon of recruitment. Have a beer. Have a girl. Have my girl. Hey, just kidding. Ain't I, baby? Billboard brother says others had it better before you, and God forbid someone has it better after you. Message to overgrow an underpass, third-rate skinny-dipping, just as friends, traveling long distances for hopes, and a supremely uncomfortable ride confusing my friends as recipients of dick pics. I shit you not, people of the future are a real phenomenon that nobody asks for. And yet here we are in a poem, spending valuable time on how uneducated we are in sex, gender, decay, and pleasure. So disappointing, you able bodies. You throbbed constellations, lounging lazily without checking screen for departures. You there, useless dude, stop messing with my friends. You there, oppressive den mother, stop messing with my friends. You there, manipulative egotist, stop messing with my friends. Shaken sugar packet fall into foam. Loud couple agree on the concept of respect. You know what I mean. There's always a thing between us. A rain thing that hides interloped throat. Makes all conversation louder and more gunfire laugh. That is siren, not enjoyment. Flee the coral cut edge. That guy has you fooled. Oh yeah, oh yeah. Lady, you better stay away. Oh yeah, oh yeah. How about 2014? Crazy year, everyone. Addressing my melancholy by National Review, model recurrence of good ally across holding back that toe to dip into power, sugarcane turned to molasses. My friends are treated as less than a bushel economy. Harvest moon, armor attention that goes forever, human code, the existence for futile meditation, fire in the hole of Yosemite's eye field, heat traits and surface tension to think that we are clandestine units of predictable motion, close it out and spread the gas masks. Forward is just backward once again. We forget how to parse the important stuff. Me, you, him, her, all gasping terminals letting the algorithm dictate opinion option, the view just one paddock of the news market. Supposedly, we're more connected than ever to the stuttering desires of suffering, now drowned under the bankroll and threat control. A woman throws the canister back to the cops.
It's weird when you have a poetry on the podcast because you can't like clap or something.
Don't clap. It's weird. No,
like, you can clap at home, folks. Well, why not, you know?
It's confusing when you're in a poetry reading and they clap after every poem. It's something that happens here that does not happen
in other places. That's a New Orleans thing. Yeah,
yeah, it's really weird. In New York, they're just like, everything's quiet and you're like, I am failing right now. Nobody likes me and I should go home right now. But here, it's very positive. I don't know what it is. It's a real thing. I'll read one more, which is Make It Rain, which is the title poem. Make It Rain is reference to strippers, also reference to Tom Waits, who's also in reference to strippers. Make It Rain. Worship arrives on air current. A missive strikes. Me. This, it's me. It's me. Rings a hidden exit. Experiment. Vibe rallies the horn section. So baby, all right. Baby, don't be so uptight. Break your back. I the escape. The fire last time we spoke was tongues and glances. Missing interdependency, replacing open door. Exits are all about horizon, or not, but usually true. Direction isn't just a concept. We doctor the word on currents now blown to the worn burgundy rug. The only thing that survived is a language we don't need to understand. Well, those are some three poems for you guys. You should definitely
those are really good.
Check yeah, them out you. If you can.
Do you use poetry as an exercise away from game design? Does it fill it in? Does it kind of fill it in, or does it come at a random
It's all point? From the same pool. So okay. Sometimes I've designed too many games and can't write any poems, or sometimes I've written too many poems and can't design any games. Recently, I've been trying to teach myself more coding so I can just combine the two and just have one pool of effort that I'm using the whole time. I'm trying to figure out a way to make... I have this 60-page long-form poem.
One about the woman eating the world?
Mm-hmm. Well, she was the universe once, but she got tricked out of it by some, like, nasty angels. And she just goes around and devours all these old gods and all these old places of power and grows enormous as she tries to bring her universe back. Which seems like a game to me. So
that'd be an interesting game.
Sounds like the Marvel universe to me.
Well, half of the poem is that, and the other half of the poem is my real life. So it's alternating stanzas, because when writing a long poem, one needs a self... perpetuating motion machine in order to make sure that you keep on going. If you're out of juice by the third page, no long poem is going to happen. So by alternating this fantasy world that I've been telling myself this story since I was a little girl, and my real life of being a woman who designs games in a very, you know, male-dominated environment, I was able to make a long-form work. And I do think that it's rife for a digital expression. Unfortunately, I don't have the coding skills to make that happen. So right now I'm trying to teach myself that skill, because for me, it's all the same pool of energy, and it'd be really nice to see if I can align those two functions into one bigger thing.
Where are you jumping in? Processing, or where are you?
Processing is what I've started on. I know HTML five pretty well, and I've been learning lots of Unity. Processing is good for sort of art motion and making sure that you're like sending graphic information through a language. Unity is really great for physics and trying to make sure that you actually have sort of, it's like a built-in game engine already. And then I've been doing like a bit of C#. And all of this, I hope one day amounts to something that I can build. I mean, it's one of those things, like if you're a poet, you apply for grants a lot, and one of the grants I apply for is to just give me money to learn all these languages to build this thing. Because I think there should be more poets in coding, because it's just tagging of language. It's the exact same thing. Like, the function of a coder and the function of a poet to me are so aligned, it's ridiculous. I mean, if anyone, like...
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities there for sure.
Yeah. And I think a lot of poets who assume that the only thing they can do with poetry is become a professor is laughable, and I think that there's use for professors, and I think they should exist, but don't sell yourself short. Language is being used in really interesting ways, and we have the mind for it, so why not take the leap into that? It's not that different.
Probably made for some more interesting games, too. Mm-hmm. To have people coming from a very different place.
Sure, and the tools are cheap now. Unity is free. Like, you can start coding immediately. You can start coding HTML immediately. Like, it's not far off. It used to be that being a poet was the cheapest artist, because all you needed was a pen and a piece of paper. And you would laugh at the photographers who needed paper and emulsion and all sorts of dark rooms and things. But now, you don't need that much.
So do you foresee some way that poetry could be hybridized with games in some sort of way? Mm-hmm. Or... Yeah. What would that look like?
I mean, I'm already doing it. I mean, you're looking at the person who's doing that right now. Like, but what do I think a successful like poetry game will look like?
Yeah.
I think it'd be beautiful if you walked around and your phone sent you a poem based upon where you were in the world and maybe some pictures you took, and it was this really positive thing that was a beautifully crafted piece of work that was about you, written as if somebody was writing you a poem and you got to read it and feel good about yourself and about your day. So it would take your geolocation. It would take how many steps you had in a day. It would take perhaps some of the pictures you took. It would take some of the things it knows you likes. And I think that that's, I mean, it's a huge undertaking, but I think that there is a really...
It would have to be like module in some way.
Of course, it would have to, you know, it'd have to be, the tagging of language would be immense, but there's a way to, if there's a way to build that algorithm into, that'd be a much nicer use of the technology than we have right now, which is like, you know, everyone owns your data and we know you like shoes, so we're going to sell you these shoes. I mean, wouldn't it be nice if instead of being rewarded for what you liked in this world were shopping options, it was an affirmation that what you enjoy this world is worthwhile and beautiful? Like, that seems pretty cool.
But is poetry's escape from that the fact that it hasn't been commodified? Is the unpopularity of poetry part of what keeps it from not being a commodity?
I mean, if it was never popular before, sure. But there was a time where I think that we're truly missing out by not having kids memorize poems as in school. I mean, there's a whole generation above us.
Yeah.
That can still recite poems they learned in grade school and feel great about it. It's not like that mental space was wasted. Anyone who recites a poem this day that's in their 70s or 80s feels strongly, because it's been this thing been touching on their whole life. They've been checking in with that thing their whole life. So the commodification of poetry, I mean, I relish the day that we're all paid poets. That sounds fantastic. But I believe that the commodification of art is always going to exist, and there's always going to be people actually doing the good work. And I did read that poetry is selling more today than it has in, I don't know, something like 15, 20 years. Which is absolutely nothing in comparison to to the world. But does it matter? No. I mean, does it matter?
I don't know. I wonder. I mean, I'm not saying necessarily, I'm just asking this question. Yeah. But I think of, like, visual art in the art market.
I don't want to participate in that.
I know, but would that be what happens to poetry if it became too commodified? And maybe there's a way to commodify it without it turning into...
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a point of it, like, I think I disagree with Joseph a little bit in film. I feel like the era of these things where they were at the strongest moments that they had are over now. Like, I feel like the reason why we have so many superhero movies out right now is because film was a medium of a former generation, and now I do believe it's interactives. And I believe that poetry probably, I mean, there's always going to be people that are at the top of their game and are amazing at it, but do I think it's the best vehicle for the current population to understand and disseminate their world? I don't. Like, it seems...
Yeah, but I don't know. I'm not trying to be down on the idea of combining poetry with technology. I think, but there's lots of ways that could happen, right?
Yeah.
That could be done in a way where it's still very underground and would not be very commodified. But I guess to have a large reach, it would have to be commodified in some sense. And I wonder how that would change what it was.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's music and vinyl versus digital distribution, right? Has that really... Do you think that's watered down music in itself, or
in some ways? I mean, not in all ways. I mean, some things about it have been very good for music, but yeah, I mean, there's no direct comparison, right? But
well, I mean, like last year, the Grammys finally accepted entries from non-labeled artists and non-physical distribution. So, like, you know, Chance the Rapper gets however many nominations. He doesn't even have a label. He doesn't have a rap. All his music is given away for free.
Sure.
You know, that's, it's sort of changing the landscape in a certain way of like that.
Yeah, which has both positive and negative things to it. But I think it probably also drowns out a lot of more avant-garde music that would have maybe been able to get some sort of foothold. Because
in the past.
you're relying so much on there being some coalescing of a big population of people liking that music in order for it to be successful. Right? Because anyone can throw stuff out there.
But that's, and, I mean, but the Grammys is, I mean, the Grammys is, any giant award is a form of censorship.
Sure. Well, yeah, of like, course.
And
yeah.
No artist should be working for awards and rewards because
just yeah.
That's never, I mean, it's saying that this has been sanctioned by the state and this is what everyone should work towards. So if we're going to go by, you know, I mean, I think it's, and I think Chance the Rapper is jamming. And I think that you will always have the, like, I think Kendrick Lamar is super important too. I think you will always have these people that stand, engage that popularity and still stand and be an interesting artistic statement. But if you're going to be looking for people who are doing cutting edge avant-garde, they're not people at the Grammys, and they shouldn't be.
No, but I feel like there is probably more of a space for those kind of musicians in the 70s and the 80s and even the 90s when you had a lot of smaller indie labels going on.
The internet's been like the world's biggest indie label, man. Like you can
but it also pushes a lot of people out because you can't be. I mean, I don't know. I think we all know people who are too small for that, right? Because if anyone can put anything out in the world, you're kind of drowning. You do drown things out in some way, right? It does just. There's a lot of noise, right? And a lot of the best things are never going to be popular on a large scale, but they do speak to the people they speak to in a very powerful way, right? But I don't know if those things can always break through the giant net of thousands and thousands of musicians putting things out there.
If there's some reason why, like, we all knew who Hazel Atkins is, and, like, is there some way that this music, if you think about anything that's existed since the 1920s, and we get to listen to it. If you think about, you know, Lightning Hopkins, what is good will remain. Like, what is good will actually stand the test of time, and that's what its popularity should go on, I think. So if you're a small blip, but you're carried strongly in the hearts of a few that can then pass it on to another few, who knows what the timing on that is? Who knows when that will actually strike lightning and make people happen? I do think that there's a chorus happening. Like, we live in a Greek chorus due to the internet, and it's insane, and our brains are, like, totally fried. So I do think there's a lot of people who deserve some due that don't get it. But what are you trying to do as an artist? Is that what you're trying to do? Or are you just trying to make a thing that's powerful?
Well, yeah, but you also have to acknowledge that there's a system set up, right? And there are a lot of artists who are trying to actually engage with something and make something that is going to connect with people. But there are a lot of people who aren't. They're trying to make money. And most of the, and the, a lot of the people who have power of pushing things forward, even in small ways, that's what they're trying to do too. So that's gonna.
Sure.
I mean, I don't know. I guess that's why I think about it with poetry. It'd be interesting. I'd love to see a world where poetry is something that feels more accessible to the general population, mm-hmm. right? And I do think, unfortunately, schools play a large part in making people afraid of poetry.
Right, because they think there's a solution to poetry. This poem can be solved. You can know the absolute ending and meaning of this thing, and when really none of us wanted that.
But I also am, in some ways, trepidatious about how that might happen, if it might kill poetry in the process. Yeah. You couldn't really truly kill it. I mean, we haven't killed music. You can't kill music either. I mean, you can't kill any of those things, but you can certainly push it into the corners in some weird way.
Mm.
Push the good stuff into the corners in some weird way, where some of it still breaks through. Like you said, some people are just, they're still going to be able to break out of that regardless of what the system set up around it is. But you're probably losing a lot of things or pushing it way out into the corners. And maybe it could come back in future generations. I don't know. Maybe someone will notice it later.
Mm.
Sure.
But the
poems on Instagram that are getting 50,000 likes are not the best poems being written today. And it's not, you know, some of these people who are doing this sort of thing. It's just a popularity contest, you know. But that's like a dangerous direction.
Yes, but it's funny in poetry, right? Because it's so, how many likes can you get on a poem at all on anything? So why are you even trying to do that?
Sure.
But I guess because it's a...
On the back end, that equals money. I mean, on the back end, it's all about making money off language.
We have so many options of the way we want to participate. If we're just going to follow what people say, these are the right avenues of participation, then, all right, man, like your Instagram poems. If you're a person who says, the way I participate is go to look in the corners, then you're the person who goes to look in the corners. Like, to think that there's one way of engaging poetry or thinking that these people who have likes, dude, power to you guys. Like, good on you, man. You're making money out of poems. Fantastic. It doesn't hurt me. I don't care.
Well, I don't know. It might hurt. It might hurt you. And it might hurt society. And I don't know. And like what you're talking about in the beginning with gaming, if we want to think about the audience experience of this thing, it's not just thinking about the audience experience to your poem. It's thinking about how is this genre received in the world too.
Or would you rather no one read any, like, would you rather them not read any of those poems at all and just shut it all down and say, I'm not even going to engage poetry on this, you know, on this weird, superfluous, like, manner and just never think about language at all? Or would you rather someone actually have a moment to think about what poetry is, even if it's this weirdly terrible train wreck of a poem?
Well, I'd rather them, you know, engage with something more real.
But you don't have that power over them.
Well, like, I don't know. Do we not have that power? I mean, I think that is not something, there's not like some, you know, czar of poetry somewhere deciding that, right? I think we're all pushing that in the direction it goes. And that's maybe our job, to help push it in a direction that's more healthy.
But you saying that Instagram poems are all terrible due to what they are makes you a czar of poetry. You just made a big...
Marco said that.
I didn't make an absolute. All I'm saying is that the poem that gets 50,000 likes on Instagram, it's not a chance of the dice. You know, it's not like some, I just don't think that some avant, I mean, I guess my whole thing about that is, you know, it's like, I would consider in a certain sense, like all flattery aside here, like doing video, looking at video game design and experience design as poetry is avant-garde. I'm just going to say it. That's how I feel about that. I think it's awesome. I think it's rad. I don't think that the avant-garde is going to rear its head on Instagram is, I guess, what I'm saying.
Right.
Is it's going to be a very like kind of like newspaper poetry kind of thing of the 19th century. It's going to be a very like, the more popular it is, the less, I don't want to say good, but the more popular it is, the more it appeals to the larger masses.
Sure.
And, you know, we all know what happens with groupthink.
But is that inherent? I mean, I think you can certainly think of artistic movements that were challenging that were still popular. And why is that not possible now? I don't know. I don't think that's as inherently possible. And I think maybe that's what I'm getting at, is that it's really about money. If you can take the more you can push the money aspect out of it, the more you make room for that being popular while still being something that is challenging and not simplistic.
I think there's a lot of movements happening in poetry that we don't have access to as who we are, that are happening outside of Instagram, outside of our cultures, outside of our communities, that we have direct access to. So I also think it's a little nearsighted to assume that we've got a grasp on everything that's happening in the avant-garde in poetry, because I think a lot of these movements happen in the small communities in small ways. I do want to say, though, that something on Instagram poetry, a lot of folks have their brain stops there, like, man, I participated. I liked a poem.
Yeah.
Look how deep I are. But there's probably 5 or 6 out of that 50,000 who's like, what is this poetry thing? Let me check out what goes deeper and pick up, you know, a Bernadette Mayer book, perhaps.
Yeah. But so, how do you make a channel from those underground corners of poetry to make it available? Because even a lot of people who like poetry, they don't know how to find that stuff.
Yeah,
like,
it's about dialogue, you know? It's about experience design. No, it's about dialogue and making sure that people have an access into having a conversation with where these movements are happening. You can't, you know, so, and that's, you can't be closed off to, if, I mean, you can absolutely do it. I'm not saying it, but if you want to make the movement bigger, you have to access and challenge those who do not normally see into your view or into your community. So it's on the poets. That's whose responsibility it is. They're the ones who should be doing this. It's not on the audience.
Yeah, well, I'd agree with that, but yeah.
And those Instagram poets, they're doing it, dude.
Well, I don't know. I don't know.
If... They're engaging their audience with poetry in a way that none of us never ever will have access to. I'm not beefing those guys.
Well, I mean, I think...
we'll save that for another episode.
Yeah. Some, yeah, but no, I do think... I guess the thing that is funny, though, about that, right? Like, I think you're right. I mean, I think there is a lot of interesting poetry going on, but it is... People don't see it, right? Or the only time people see it is when those poets engage directly with people, which is usually through poetry readings, right? Which is great. And I do think a lot of times that is the way people get to hear something they would have never heard before, even people who are not particularly into poetry, if they're open enough to let someone convince them to go to one. Mm-hmm. but I don't know. I guess I'm pontificating about something that's probably not realistic, yeah, and about how do you make that more of something someone could have an experience of. But sure.
I guess so be it. If you know, if poetry's coming, if the channel for poetry these days is Instagram, okay, that's no, that's one thing. You know, poetry reading's another thing. A book that someone gives you is another thing. So there's all these different levels, you know, that we're playing on, I think. And it's like, we've got the digital media world, we've got the physical media world, we've got the experiential world, is like going to a reading and experiencing what a reading is. Some people may like to experience a reading and appreciate that. Some people want to have the private experience of reading the poetry book on the train. Some people want to have the experience of flipping through Instagram and seeing poetry that way. So I think, like, I think the success there is that it is the amount of media that it is permutating is larger, and that's a positive thing in the end, you know, whether it's coming through experience design or whether it's coming through social media or something. And I guess that's a success. I think it's interesting to see how poetry essentially attaches itself to all these different mediums, mm-hmm. you know, and how it's come through over the years. Because it used to be just like what you said earlier, it was, and part of the oral tradition is memorizing the poems. Mm-hmm. That what you said, the generation prior, sure. here has those poems. And I memorized poems in grade school too. Like we did, you know, but I think it's like that, but that was the originality of it, right? Was like the resuscitation and the oral history part of it, of remembering and passing it down. And then we bring in print, and then we bring in other mediums, and then there's theater, which is part of poetry too. And, you know, there's all these different mediums that's coming through. So now as we move into these new mediums, this is what we're seeing we're seeing the same old things applied in new ways, mm-hmm. you know?
Well, poets just shouldn't be in conversation with other poets. So these Instagram folks are accessing a crowd that poets never get to talk to. And so if you're just going to be a poet that reads to other poets in a poetry reading, that's why you're in the corner.
Wow, there we go. There is a little truth to that. And, you know, that would be my complaint about the MFA sometimes, because it eats itself. You know, right. it's like...
Well, every kid had to memorize a poem in elementary school, whether you were interested in writing or not. I mean, you were forced to engage with poetry in a way that you would have never had otherwise. I'm not saying we need to, like, guerrilla-ize poetry and make sure, like, you non-poet, you listen to this CD, right? You're going to do it. But there was a time where it was assumed that it was for everyone, not just the literary. And we shouldn't assume or try to... I mean, I would rather poetry readings be full of architects and engineers and scientists. I know it's hard to access all those folks, but we're not doing that different work. So why not make that a conversation?
I agree. I mean, I think that'd be great. But if you had someone publishing on Instagram the kind of stuff that people are reading at poetry readings, no one would give a shit about it. I mean, to be realistic, part of the issue is the reason people are liking those things on Instagram is because it's easily digestible, not because they're reaching a larger audience. The reason they're reaching a larger audience is because it's digestible, right? And the reason those people are reading at poetry readings is because that's the only people who's going to listen to them.
Well, then that's a sad state of affairs, and you should try harder. I mean,
well, not just the only people that are going to listen to them. I think people do, you know, you do get unusual people show up at poetry readings who aren't people into poetry, and sometimes that makes a real connection. But I don't think, I mean, if you had, you know, some, you know, language poet posting things on Instagram, I don't think that's going to get many likes. Like,
one will never tell because they're not doing it.
I think there are people doing it.
People trying, maybe. Well, let's try. Maybe that's an experiment.
Yeah, there
maybe
you go. There you
maybe
go.
That's an experiment. Maybe we need to start trying and, you know, get, you know, let's race to 1 million followers. That's what we'll call it. Well, this has been great. I think, you know, it's the success here is we have at the end of this program, we have more questions than we do answers.
Well, yeah,
to questions
no,
we started.
It's a different way of thinking about
it. Yeah, it is absolutely a different way of thinking about it. So we're all staring at each other, like figuring out, you know, what's the next
thing. How do you end a podcast?
So there we are. We've been talking about things in a new way, and that's a success.
Yeah. And thank you for joining us today and sharing your poetry with us.
Thanks for having me.
Where are you
me.
Off to next?
I'm going next back to New York to work on a desert center that's going to be in a World Expo in Dubai. So I'm going to be designing the interactives and the games for people to come in there, where I think it's like 2 million people are just to go through it. So
wow,
that's pretty cool. And I have to make a second iteration of a really, really dirty game I made for Bravo. And so I'll go to New York. And then after that, because I can work from anywhere, wherever my computer is, maybe I'll be in Austin or Portland after that.
All right. Any plans to come back to New Orleans?
Always plans to come
always
back
plans
to New Orleans.
That's good to hear. That's good to hear. Well, great. We've had a great, lively discussion today, and pick up. We'll try to make Jess's chapbook available. We'll link it to it, or tell you some how to get
put it.
Put to try to move some copies of Make It Rain. Mm-hmm. And we look forward to the next project. I guess this is the Woman Who Devours the World, right?
That's what I'm going to try to work on next.
That
sounds
absolutely awesome. That sounds awesome.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for coming.